And welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of October 8th, 2019. Today we're joined by our co-host, the author and educator, Ms. Mariah Tinger. How you doing, Mariah?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Good. And we're thrilled to be joined for a second time by Nathan Phillips, who is a professor of Earth Science and Environment at the Boston University, where I did a postdoc many years ago in the physics department. But anyway, Nathan, welcome. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks, Ted, and good to see you again, Mariah.
And well. Mariah, you teach at BU, right? This is like a BU reunion?
I do. Okay, yeah, so it's a big BU party.
Yes, indeed. So let me set this up in the following way, that many of us either bought houses or were convinced to use natural gas as a clean and efficient way to heat our homes. I mean, that's been driven into my skull for many decades now. Natural gas, clean and efficient compared to nasty oil heating, right? You always wanted natural gas. So many homes in Massachusetts utilize natural gas. Of course, the delivery of natural gas relies on a vast what we call infrastructure, right? Just a fancy word for all the pipes that run under the street that deliver the gas from wherever the gas comes from to your own home, right? And everyone knows that there's a meter in the basement that's measuring the gas, how much gas is coming in, et cetera, et cetera. If you start thinking about it, you can ask questions like, how long ago were those pipes laid in, right? If you're in downtown Boston, when did they put in natural gas pipelines? And what state are they in? So, of course, they're in Massachusetts, but what state of repair are they in, I guess I should say? All those things you don't think about at first blush for the use of natural gas. But, Nathan, you have done some thinking about natural gas as at a system level, I guess I would say. Right? Is that fair to say? And if that's the case, what should people know about the natural gas delivery system that they is invisible but they rely on?
Yeah, sure. So I started about 10 years ago studying the natural gas systems by literally two blocks from my home finding out about a leak in the natural gas system from my research partner Bob Ackley. And you can't start looking at one little piece of this system without just starting to ask the question, well, what's upstream of here and is there any problems there? And so over these last 10 years that I've been looking at this, I've gone from mapping and understanding thousands of leaks under the city of Boston, that this is actually a problem across the eastern seaboard in the pipes that are delivering the gas to our city, our buildings and our offices and our homes, to the issues associated on a larger system scale, the pipelines that are being built out to increase our dependency on natural gas, the fracking that's happening, you know, the whole system from wellhead all the way to burner tip. And then things like the proposed Weymouth.
I think you just named the show, station. Nathan. From wellhead to burner tip. That's okay, keep going.
Well, you can have leaks across that entire, and you do have leaks across that entire process chain, including in our own homes. And so we have these issues like the infrastructure that's being proposed in Weymouth, as well as the gas explosions and the system level collapse that we saw in the Merrimack Valley as well. So we're understanding at a range of scales the problems with natural gas. At the same time, go ahead.
I was just going to ask you, you said before mapping natural gas leaks. So I can imagine that the utilities have some idea of where there are leaks, where the leaks are, and then they make a judgment about whether or not to fix them. But I think at the same time, you have been physically seeking them out yourself with some kind of a gas meter, right? Is that fair to say?
Yeah, so we use very sensitive equipment and typically pick up 2 to 3 times the number of leaks that the utilities are able to see on the streets and sidewalks.
And do you just walk down the sidewalk and when the thing starts to react, you say, oh, I'm near a leak? I mean, you just have a search grid and you just kind of look around? Is that the idea?
Yeah, so Mm-hmm. We published the first study of its kind in any city in Boston in 2013, where we mapped 3,356 gas leaks from the natural gas pipeline system. And we did that driving a car with a very high precision sniffer for methane, with a GPS unit on top of the car. So it's the data stream's all coming in, and we plot this on Google Earth, basically. We also needed to know that if we measure an elevated methane level somewhere on the streets, that it's coming from the pipelines rather than maybe a broken sewer main or a stagnant water or something like that. And we had ways, there are chemical signatures or fingerprints of the pipeline gas that we were able to ascertain means that the leaks that we saw were from that pipeline system.
And so that, I think that's an image that people should carry around in their head. I mean, all these pipelines underground are not perfectly sealed. There is just this steady, miasma of natural gas rising up on the streets, right, which is not good for, like, I'm sure you can detail all the reasons why that's not good. There are some hot spots where the leaks are bigger, but it's by no means some kind of sealed system, right? So is that fair to say?
Yes, and Mariah, did you want to add?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really interesting question. There's two things that stand out to me that, you know, you found 2 to 3 times more leaks than the natural gas company is reporting, which is not tremendously surprising, right? I imagine that it's in their interest to downplay that. I don't know intentionally or not. Maybe they just don't have the sophistication that you did with your equipment. But when you said that found 3,356 gas leaks, you know, are these like minor things? Do you have any context of the actual health impacts that could be giving to the community around it?
Yeah. Yes, so those were the questions that came right out after we made that study and published that. And so two things happened after that. One was our next study was like, well, what does it all amount to? And so with collaborators, we used the integrating power of the atmosphere to measure how much of all these leaks were building up into the atmosphere. And that's where we estimated from measurements that about 2.7% of the gas that was delivered into the Commonwealth was leaking straight into the atmosphere. That might not sound like a lot, but it was $90 million a year in lost commodity value, and about 10% of Massachusetts' entire greenhouse gas emissions inventory from all sectors that were not on any books at all. So that was answering one of your questions. And then another question was that we also wanted to know, if you've got 3,356 leaks in Boston, how do you start patching them? Do you just randomly go to one or the other? And that's where a PhD student at BU, Margaret Hendrick, did a study that then found, she published that in 2016, that found that 7% of those leaks account for 50% of the leaked gas.
Oh, really?
So we call those super emitters, and that's a result, a science result, that basically tells you the policy. Find and fix the biggest leaks. And that opened up a whole new policy direction for us, because once you can have a cost-effective and efficient way to find and fix those big ones, it buys you the ability to start thinking about, well, how do we triage this system by getting the worst of these leaks, and then think about transitioning off of gas altogether.
Wow. I mean,
what about the health effects?
Excellent question. And that body of research is just increasing at a very rapid rate. So what we know, what's well established, is that leaks in the street and in the outdoors, methane and ethane, which is also in the pipeline gas, they react photochemically to produce things like ground level ozone, which is bad for all living things, including our lungs.
And ozone, just so people know, ozone is that sort of electric smell you get from an electric train, right? That sort of clean your nostrils out kind of smell. And that's not good stuff, because it's basically burning up your lungs, right? Very reactive gas.
It's basically eating away at your biological tissues. We want ozone up in the stratosphere. We do not want ozone down where we're breathing. And so that's one problem. Formaldehyde is another outdoor problem caused by these gas leaks. But then when we go inside the house, and this is where the research is really starting to increase, I had a leak in my own home in Newton in the basement it wasn't at an explosion risk level, but there was leaks. Everywhere there's a valve connection or a fitting of some sort is an opportunity for a leak, at the meters, wherever. And so you can have low-grade leaks, but when it's leaked into your home, then you're starting to think, oh, well, what else is in that gas? There's methane, there's ethane, all these hydrocarbons, and this whole set of volatile organic compounds that are really bad for human health. So the big question now is, what is human exposure indoors to gas leaks?
Somewhere I heard that, well, I mean, I'm confident of the fact that since the natural gas comes out of the ground, there is some component of radioactive gas even involved in this. And that transports, we spoke in another show about the signature of the chemical footprint. I mean, you see certain chemicals at certain levels. But, I mean, is it true that if there's a natural gas leak, it's potentially, depending on where the gas comes from, containing substances that have been buried, that are radioactive for one thing, or other things that have been buried and now dug up out of the ground from a long time ago, right?
Yeah, that's part of the concern. So radon, for example, many of us know that if you buy a home, you need to get a radon inspection to make sure that you don't have radiation from, you know, natural earth materials in your house. Well, this gas is coming from a mile below the surface of the earth. And it's coming from a variety of different places in like Pennsylvania, the Marcellus Shale. And even within that, there are going to be different locations. So there's a big question mark about what's in the gas when it's coming out. And because of the so-called, is it the Halliburton loophole, whatever, that the companies don't even have to disclose what's in the gas, what they add to the fracking material, as well as what kind of materials are in that gas and coming out. And so for something like radon, which I think you're the physicist, Ted, but I think it has a half-life of four and a half days or something like that. So part of it depends on the speed at which the gas is getting from where it's brought out of the ground to where it's consumed, the daughter products that may also be radioactive and those kinds of issues. So yeah, a lot of different concerns. Also concerns when you even combust the gas, when it does what it's supposed to do. If you're cooking with gas, we know that oxides of nitrogen are produced, and that's not good for respiratory health. We know that there's particulate matter, so-called PM2.5, that is produced, and that's not good for human health as well. So there's a range of issues associated with gas, outdoor and indoor.
And those are, to Mariah's point, these are health issues having nothing to do with sort of the climate effect of this. You said before, a stunning thing that, I mean, basically 7% of the leaks amount to something like 10% of the total greenhouse gas emissions, right? If I caught those two numbers properly, right? 7% of the leaks are a huge amount of the gas, right?
Yeah, 7% of the leaks account for 50% of the gas that's leaked from the pipelines. Mm. And if you add up the sum total of all of those leaks, it's about 10% of the greenhouse gas emissions inventory for the commonwealth.
Which is this huge thing that at some level we talk about the Green New Deal and how we got to get clean energy and whatnot. But man, I mean, this is just sitting, all that is money and you know, and will to go fix the leaks, right? To begin with, and then potentially to get away from the gas ultimately, but
$90 million.
Right. I mean, it's wow. That's remarkable.
Yeah. Well, since you brought up the Green New Deal, really there is a way to pivot and move towards cleaner, safer energy, thermal energy systems. We have a pathway. Working with the nonprofit out of Cambridge, HEAT, the Home Energy Efficiency Team, they've worked to develop a district-level heating system that can basically be considerations instead of just replacing these gas pipelines with new gas pipelines. About 7,000 miles, about a third of our pipeline system in Massachusetts, about 21,000 miles of pipe, about 7,000 we need to do something with it because it's leak-prone pipe. Right now, ratepayers are committed to over $9 billion to replace those with more gas lines, which are going to last 50 or 60 years. So what we've seen is that it's more cost-effective for us to think about in those places transitioning to thermal energy from the earth, ground sourced heat pumps on street scales, delivering clean and safe, basically renewable heat to homes and businesses.
There's so many interesting things there. Let me just catch one. You said that the ratepayers are committed to some, I think you said $9 billion to put in new pipelines, right? Is that, did I hear that correctly?
Yes.
And that, and I mean, and that, that $9 billion could be alternately spent, and you said the word district. I just want to make sure that's, I mean, basically like neighborhood all relying on one heat pump that then is distributed under the ground, similar to the natural gas, I guess, right? I mean, the pipes that would bring in the heating stuff, right? And that is a path forward away from spending $9 billion for new pipes that are all going to go bad and have all these other negative consequences. I mean, who committed, I'm a ratepayer, who committed me to spend $9 billion on new pipes? When did that happen? I guess I wasn't paying attention.
Right, as many of us weren't. And so the Department of Public Utilities has promulgated this rule and regulation, this program called the Gas System Enhancement Program, GSEP, and that is a over $9 billion commitment by ratepayers to fund the replacement of pipes to the profit of the utility shareholders. Wow. And so, you know, we need to think seriously that we're at a crossroads right now for our energy decisions. And you know, the DPU works for us. The legislature and the administration, they work for us. So we need to be raising the issue. Is this really the direction we want to go? Or do we want to think about other directions for our, you know, a cleaner, safer energy system that's consistent with our commitments, the Global Warming Solutions Act?
So what you're presenting is this sort of, this sort of pragmatic, like, here's something you can do. We're right here in Massachusetts. This $9 billion, we've already promised to do this crazy thing with the old style energy. And we need to, I mean, if you're in Massachusetts and you're looking for a place to try to do climate work, here's this very pragmatic thing that has so many tentacles reaching into so many, oh, my God.
So, I mean, I think that's a good question. You say, right, so what is our best course of action here? Do we support heat, right? Do we get out there and sort of, you know, find out more information?
Right?
H-E-E-T, right? Home Energy and Efficiency Team. Do
yes.
we...
Well,
how do we sort of move this needle?
Right. So it's heatma.org. First of all, go there, find out the excellent, great work that they're doing. And also there's this bill called the Future Act. And I'm forgetting what the acronym is, but it is an acronym, but it's about the future of the utilities. And this group that I work with called the Gas Leak Allies, we spend a lot of time working and talking with legislators. And so Senator Cynthia Cream is the sponsor of this Future Act. I wish I had the Senate
acronym for
number,
it. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, we can look that up. And I'm sorry, I'm forgetting the
number.
But it's really for the utilities. It's an evolve or die bill that gives them a pathway forward to use the same grant of location, to use the same right-of-way where that old leaking gas pipeline is. And instead of just doing business as usual and laying a new pipeline, they can lay down a pipe, an insulated water pipe that's connected to a series of ground source heat pumps that is distributing clean, safe heat to the buildings on that block. And it can be piloted. It's an innovation bill. And so it really allows a pathway, a managed, orderly way in which we can actually transition and transform the energy system of basically the 19th century into the energy system that we know we need for the 21st century.
Yeah. I have the bill number. It's Bill H.2849. And it's an act for utility transition to using renewable energy, right? So that's the future, for utility transition to using renewable energy.
Wow.
So there's the back on there.
That's my God. That's the really, really interesting. I dabble. I feel like a dilettante. I know that Naomi Klein wrote a book called The Shock Doctrine, which always, and I read enough of the book, I can't pretend I read the whole book, to say that, you know, you need plans in place for when something bad happens, right? We haven't even touched on the ideas of, you know, we just had another huge leak of natural gas in Lawrence, and a year ago we had the terrible tragedy in Merrimack. I mean, the kinds of things I see you're working on, Nathan, is like, when something like that happens, you've got a ready-made plan saying, okay, do this, right? Step in and don't just go to the old knee-jerk reaction of replace all the pipes. You say, here's the new path. Is that a fair, kind of relevant statement? I mean, that this is in preparation for the next disaster? I mean, addition to being a thoughtful way that you choose to do, but I mean, it seems like, you know, we're going to have more explosions, right? We haven't even talked about the explosion risk with all the health and global warming impacts, right?
Yeah, so that's the thing about the problems with natural gas is that, you know, pick your poison. I mean, it's a climate agent, a serious climate heating element. When it leaks, it kills trees, it pollutes the air inside and outside, and it explodes. And we have problems like we saw in the Merrimack Valley a year ago. And then just to, you know, last week on the, what day that was, this gas leak in Lawrence that traumatized that community in Lawrence all over again.
Right.
The trust has been lost. The human error that apparently was involved there, the compound human error with a water crew puncturing a pipe that was not disabled, a valve that was not disabled and should have been, really shows that. And, you know, this is all on a newly built, rebuilt system. And so it's pointing out something that we've made very clear in a our own gas safety report that we issued on September 13th, 1 year after the 2008 explosions, that point out that the gas system that we have has intrinsic vulnerabilities to large-scale failures, and, you know, that we can never say never again by virtue of how the architecture of that system delivering combustible gases has these inherent risks to them, which are avoidable by transitioning to cleaner and safer, intrinsically cleaner and safer forms of energy.
Oh, I'm exhausted, Nathan.
Sorry. I think
this is fair. We've got to maintain our pledge to stay within a certain amount of time, so we should stop at this point. Fascinating discussion. What we'll do is we'll put up links. I'm going to have to go back through this and catch all these interesting links. Nathan, you just made another reference to a report you released on September 13th, right? The anniversary. I'm going to try and get all those pulled together. We'll put them in a blog at massclimateaction.org/blog where you can check this stuff out. And it really, I mean, it's an interesting and important topic. So you can also find this show on the MCAN Facebook page at /MassClimateAction. You can send us a note on your experience with natural gas and what you think about it to podcast@massclimateaction.net. You can find us on almost any of the modern podcast distribution applications. Our friend D.R. Tucker, we are grateful to him for his continued research support. And we're going to close where we always close, by saying that we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, that we accept responsibility for building a durable future, and that we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out. And because of that, we must insist that the United States transform its energy sector over the next decade under a just and equitable plan that uses regulation, investment, and a price on carbon to safeguard our collective future. So, Mariah, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Nathan, thank you so much for your insight. It's been fascinating, great conversation. We appreciate it.
Thank you both.
Everyone, we'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Very cool.